Hey guys, I'm back again. I mean, the speed is just incredible. I think I'm doing 2 podcasts or more a week, but there are just so many incredible people out there. So I want to thank you once again for all your help with Patreon, donations, signing up for my newsletter and membership. It is so, so appreciated and important. So, let's get going.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
I'm here today with my new friend Susie Mazzoli, and Susie is someone I haven't known for very long. I was recently invited very kindly to a conference in New York this fall, and Susie was the one that invited me. And while we were talking to each other, I just felt, whoa, I really want to learn something more here. So she has a very interesting background. So Susie, thank you so much for coming on the show, and maybe you would be kind enough to give us a little background about yourself and so on.
Sure. So I was born in Australia, thus the accent, but very quickly went to live in Hungary, which is the land of my ancestors, my parents. I went when I was 21 to spend a year actually just at the Academy of Fine Arts doing my master's. And I landed a very interesting job, which was more or less in the contemporary art world, doing curating and organizing exhibitions and working with contemporary artists in Hungary, and that was funded by the Soros Foundation, by George Soros. It was a very small program, and then I built up that program into being something more formidable and certainly more interesting and more compatible with the rest of the international art world. And then I stayed in Hungary, and George Soros invited me to become the director of a network that was building on top of his already established foundations in Eastern Europe. So I ended up spending 9 years developing a network in Eastern Europe with the foundation, and then spent a few more years in Eastern Europe, and then came over to America. And here my life changed completely, and where I was working in the contemporary art world and was curating and organizing symposia and conferences and exhibitions and things. And I learned that my husband was sick with cancer, and he eventually died of cancer. And then I wanted to leave the art world and go back into something that I thought was perhaps even closer to my own state of mind, perhaps, which was natural healing. And I went back to school and became a homeopath and studied many different methods. And now I'm kind of in all sorts of different pies, doing all sorts of different work, primarily involved with spiritual pursuits and teaching spirituality and energy healing and organizing conferences. And I have my own YouTube channels where I'm also interviewing people. To me, there is so much information that's behind the scenes that people have no idea about. And that's what I'm most interested in doing, is helping people find out who they really are and what their power really is. So that's in brief my background.
And that was the interview for today. So thank you for listening, and see you next week. No, I'm only kidding. can we go back a little bit? Because
absolutely.
Do you speak Hungarian?
I do, yes.
You do? Yo. Wow.
With a strong Australian accent.
I'm sure, but that's very unusual, as I'm sure. So how did you find Hungary? What year did you go back? Was it before the wall came down?
Before the wall, yes, it was very interesting. So I went there as a child when I was 10 years old in 1975. And I spent a few weeks there with my family, And then it was, you know, still very much a socialist country. And then I went there again as a 21-year-old, and it was obviously the most westernized version of the Eastern Bloc. And but I was there as a student, and I had rented an apartment, so often I would come home and my apartment had been gone through, my things had been, you know, put all over the floor, and someone had gone through my things. My mail was always opened, all of my packages and everything. So there was that kind of intrusion into your life. I'm pretty sure I was perhaps being looked at, you know. And Hungary was in major transition. It was a really, really incredible time to be there. And
I think for most listeners or many listeners who haven't been in Europe when the Eastern Bloc was there and so on before the wall came down, it's very hard to even imagine what it was like. I traveled quite a lot through the Eastern Bloc countries before the Iron Curtain came down, but it was like a totally different world. Even though, like you say, Hungary was the most westernized country of them all, but still, when you came there the first time and so on, how did you feel? I mean, from coming from Australia, it must have been very, very different. Were your family still there? Your grandparents?
Yes, I had at the time my grandmother, who I was very close to, and aunts and uncles and cousins from my mother's side of the family. And so for me, there was like a coming home feeling and knowing my ancestry. But it's funny because in Australia I felt strange because I was of Hungarian origin, and then in Hungary I felt strange because I was a Westerner, and now I'm in America and
so
it just keeps going, right?
Yeah.
You always feel strange. I mean, there was very, very, you know, practical things like I was a vegetarian, I still am, and it was very hard to buy food and to buy fresh fruit and vegetables during the winter time. It was very, very grim pickings. And then, like when it was Christmas time, they would have the fruit sellers would come into the market square, and you could go and buy like a kilo of oranges, which was like, whoa, it's Christmas time, I can get a kilo. And there was shortages. I remember once there was a shortage of all paper goods, no toilet paper, no paper napkins, no nothing. So things like that were very, very different to my upbringing, of course, in Australia. But what was so amazing about living in Hungary was how incredibly cultured the people were, like across the board, you know, from farm workers to bankers to you know, teachers, that everyone had access to culture, and people did go to museums and they did go to art shows and they went to the opera, and things were dirt cheap. Like I can't remember the prices, but it was like 20 cents to go to the opera. And the classical culture was so rich, and of course it still is. The music academy and the very, very, very rich theatre scene. So it was interesting to be there as a young person. I was very interested in socialism and how people could live in a more equal environment, so to speak. But of course, you know, you see behind, and you see the corruption, and you see all the goings on behind the scenes. And that's interesting how I ended up actually being involved with the Soros Foundation too, just because I saw the foundation as an organisation that was helping people to become more open society, more liberated, and to have more freedoms.
I would really like to hear, because one of the things, I bicycled one time down through Europe on my own, and I came through Hungary as well, and it was just such a nice experience. I thought it was so friendly people and so kind, and even though I had major problems with the language, because there was not a lot of people speaking English, or I would say more or less none at that time, not that I met. But
they speak German.
Sorry?
Mainly German was their second language. Yeah.
But the thing is that in the old days, where Vienna was the center for so much with of culture and music and so on, Hungary is so close as well. So there were so many of these big of the old masters that came in and out of Hungary and traveled through and so on. So it's an incredible history and so many, many treasures when it comes to culture, I would say. But so it's really interesting for you, for me to meet someone who was there before the changes, because the changes are massive now since the wall came down. So, but how did they see you coming from the outside? I mean, I don't think there were that many people from Australia that could speak Hungarian.
Well, there was quite a few people that had come from their families, from the diaspora, had come back to study, whether they were studying medicine or at the art academy. There were also a lot of international students from other communist countries. There were students from Africa. Some of my friends were from Sierra Leone and Cuba as well. So there was quite a large expat population. And there was, during the time of the change, it was very interesting because there were people that were so underground and that were coming forth. And just now, I was just speaking with my cousins recently, that the people that came up in that 87, 88, 89 time that were the underground people, that they've also now become the people that everyone dislikes. So
the
turning of the wheel that they came to power and then, and I, you know, I don't know the names, would choose not even to name people, but the people that had come up through so much of that revolutionary process actually ended up becoming, again, you know, the disliked leaders, the people
But this is
engaged.
What I call revolution, that
yes.
It just revolves. It
exactly.
Revolves until,
yeah.
until we can let go of greed and all of these, I wouldn't call them human aspects, but these I want, then mm-hmm. power will corrupt people and it will just keep turning around. So it's sad to see it happening again and again on so many different areas.
Mm-hmm.
But so then you went back. You were 21 when you went back as a student, yeah?
Yes. And then I went for 1 year. My intention was to go back to Melbourne University and do my doctorate, and I ended up staying for 11 years in Hungary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
In what and part?
I was living in Budapest, and then. But as I had built up the centre in Budapest, and then when George Soros asked me to follow where he had established foundations, then I ended up working in 23 cities throughout Eastern Europe. So,
wow.
you know, the Baltics, Russia, Ukraine, down in south in Macedonia and Serbia. And so that's when I really saw just how much communism, socialism had impacted people's lives. And like, just to, for one example, when I was working in Albania, there was one artist who I met with who had gone to jail for 3 years doing hard labor because he had a book of Picasso in his apartment. So the regime was that was probably the most dramatic I saw in terms of the art world, but the regime was so clamping down on anything that was non-realistic representation. So Picasso, unbelievable. Yeah.
That is why I think it's so interesting to speak about these things, because it's very hard for many to even imagine. I mean, I was in Romania just before the revolution, and I mean,
do you mean the fake revolution? Or the real revolution?
Yeah. Well, depends on how you see it. I don't know enough about it to talk about it, but it was just before the so-called revolution, and they people were so poor, and it was like there was nothing in the shops. They were totally empty. And I remember we were coming, there were no street lights, no nothing. And there we just saw this, I came in a truck together with a friend, and we just saw this faint light, you know, in the dark. So we just stopped just in case. And it turned out that there was a train crossing, and they had just put like a wooden bar across, and there was a candle. And it was a candle we saw. I mean, and
Yeah, the Romanians were very famous for not using their headlights when they were driving at night because
Oh.
they didn't have the money, or I think the parts didn't exist. So it was very dangerous to drive there. But I have to say, I was organizing conferences way back in the 80s, even in Eastern Europe. And right after the Romanian Revolution, we organized a conference about the Romanian Revolution. So I guess that was my first kind of false flag kind of
Wow.
work that I did. But it was fascinating. So as the head of my center in Budapest, I had connections with all of the embassies, with the British Council, the cultural arms of the diplomatic services. And so through all of these services, we could always invite speakers to come to our conferences and to our events. So I went to the American embassy and I asked if there would be some expert that could come and speak at this conference about the Romanian Revolution, question mark. And they sent someone over who was actually from NASA, very interesting. And so we had all these different speakers come and then we invited the people from the Romanian television. Remember that famous footage of the
Yeah.
station? And all those people are walking in like farmers and coal miners, and they're all walking in saying, "This is the revolution." Some of the people that were the hosts of the TV show came over from Romania. So we had a very interesting group, and Peter Weibel, who's an Austrian theoretician and media analyst, he was there. He actually produced a book on this event, and it was called The Romanian Revolution, The Media Are With Us, if my memory serves me correctly. And it was very interesting because I was one of the moderators, and the whole thing was filmed and documented. And I was asking the TV people, like, what happened, like, step by step by step, like, how did this whole thing happen? And it was really, really questionable what their story was and how this whole thing fitted together. And so just looking back on that event now, I think it was very clearly a planned event that was planned to look like it was a spontaneous revolution. But from all the research we've done so far, it was not. But it was fascinating to do it. And at that time in Budapest, I received death threats for putting on this conference, this symposium. And we had to have security actually at the museum. And we had to have all of our audience members vetted. And I remember it was very funny, the NASA guy, he was going to some NATO conference as well in Europe. And, people were showing videos and doing slides and things. And he put up a video, and it was clearly the wrong video. It was some sort of like really high-tech battle gear that they were using, like VR battle gear. Oh, that's right. We had people there from virtual reality, from Mondo 2000. Well, it was a great conference. So false flags back then.
Did this execution of the people in power, of the couple,
Ceausescu?
Yeah. Was that real or was it?
I doubt that it was real. I think I've heard so many versions and received so much information of that I would also question that.
Mm.
Yeah.
It really is incredible because I thought I knew a lot of history because I history has interested me always, but I've learned from history books and so on and documentaries, official documentaries. I'm on learning on a daily basis. It's like,
isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, it is.
It's so liberating. Yeah.
But it's at the same time, it's like, oh my, are you kidding me? That as well? Because when were we told the real truth? It's been a while, I would say. But
yeah.
Tell me when you met George Soros. I'm sure that quite a few listeners have sort of got the tea in the wrong throat when they heard George Soros here. What I really find fascinating is to get in touch with people that have been in direct touch with these so-called powerful. I mean, there's big question marks from many people around this individual. I am one that very much questioned his intentions. But they're often very kind and polite and in normal day life, or I don't know, how was it to meet him? How did the first meeting, what happened then?
So, you know, I'm just like, you know, like a lowly little curator in a museum. And I was hired by the museum, not by George Soros or by his Hungarian Foundation. I was hired by the museum because, in fact, the lady that was there, she was out on maternity leave. So, you know, I was going to fill in for a few months. That was it. And, you know, I was 21 years old. Mm. And, you know, an artist, a curator. And so when I met him, I thought he was this interesting. I didn't know very much about his politics. All I knew was that he was funding, it was $2,000 a year or something like that, that he was funding this program, and that he was also starting to do other programs in Eastern Europe. That's all I knew. So when I met him, I was a little bit nervous, of course, but he seemed to me to be someone that was very powerful and had a vision, but, you know, like anybody else in that position, had absolutely no understanding about contemporary art, and why should he? And so most of the time in my work within the foundation, it was to defend the importance of creativity and in particular contemporary art, because I also continue to believe that artists are usually the forerunners. You know, they usually are the radical people, and in most cases they have freedom to express. So, you know, these George Soros and many of the board members and the people of the foundation, they wanted to provide funding for people to, you know, be get scholarships to go to England or America. So it was mainly around education and scholarships and exchanges and things like that. So to be spending money on artists or exhibitions was really out there. So in most of the cases in my relationship with George and with everybody else, I was in the mode of promoting the importance of how contemporary art can be this bringer of change and be a part of the so-called opening up of Eastern Europe, or the liberation of Eastern Europe. And I truly believe that. So it's only many, many years later that I look back and think, wow, what apparatus was I an integral part of, you know?
Mm, yeah. It's I think it's very true what you say, because when you look at as soon as a dictator takes over in a country or there's a military coup, the people they get rid of are artists and poets and
writers.
These ones are the ones that go first, almost before guerrilla fighters, because they know the power of art and how it can change society. So, so it's interesting that a man like George Soros would be involved, I think, in what, at least from your point of view, sounded or looked like a liberation of artists from the communist world. But was that the impression you got?
Well, this program was a tiny, tiny program in a huge, I don't know, million-dollar program in Budapest. He started his foundation actually in South Africa. That was the first one. And then he came and did it in Hungary. That was the first of the East European foundations. And then from Hungary, he went to all the other countries. Now, for those people that don't know, George is a Hungarian Jew who managed to escape his horrific agenda by being looked after actually by a Hungarian family, and he went to London. He escaped to London, and the story is, you know, with a dime in his pocket, and went to the School of Economics, met Karl Popper, and learned about the Open Society philosophy. So after he made all this money, he wanted to give back and to free these socialist countries and to allow people to live their lives as an open society. So
is he tall or short, or It's interesting for me because you see them on TV, but they can be like 150 and then, or 210.
So I'm 5'7½, I think. And he was maybe a bit taller than me. You know, I don't even think he's a bit taller than me, I think. Yeah. So the reason I met him was because he was in Hungary at the time that I was opening a big exhibition that was funded by the foundation. And so I asked him to open the exhibition, I think, if I remember. And that's when I first met him, was at the opening of the exhibition. And there was, you know, thousands of people. It was a big deal. And we gave out, oh, that's right, we gave out prizes, I think, or scholarships or something at the exhibition, and he gave them out. So that's when it started, the relationship. And then he saw how successful it was. And each year I would ask for more money for the program. And what the foundation was doing was making documentations on artists. So of course, in a lot of Eastern Europe, the official artists that followed the, you know, they were the ones that received the grants and received the commissions, and their pictures hung in the exhibition halls, blah, blah, blah. And so the foundation was given this small grant to document artists that were important artists that had nothing to do with the official agenda. So they hired art historians and they hired photographers and they documented the work of people that might have never been documented had it not been for this program. And there were other people, other organisations, other foundations like the Rockefeller, various foundations that were also offering grants to East European artists or curators or conservators, museum staff. And so what I did was I organized like a hub so that people could funnel their information through us. So it would be like an umbrella. And so artists could come to us for help to get scholarships in the world, but also people from the world could come to us and look at work from Hungary that didn't have a particular official bias. And we set up like an artist data lab where every single person, they didn't even have to have a qualification, could give us their slides and bio. And then say someone was coming, for example, from New York, which in fact several people did, and they wanted to see what was the contemporary work, then they would go through it by themselves without any kind of, you know, manipulation or influence, and they would pick up the artists, and then we would go and introduce them and do studio visits. And in fact, that's how we were participating in a big show at Artist Space Gallery in New York back in the late 80s or early 90s. So it was about creating this exchange. And George Soros saw that this was getting successful. And then he said, you know, I'd like you to go to every country where we already have a foundation and set up the same system. And so that's how I became the executive director for Eastern Europe. And basically I designed everything from letterheads to exhibitions. And then I went to each country and I interviewed artists and museum people, and I did like a kind of survey, tried to find like the cutting edge, most unaffected politically, you know, so they had nothing to do with politics people, and that really knew what contemporary art was. And then I recommended them to become staff and to become board members. And then in this way, we created this big 23 country network that had a huge, huge influence in Eastern Europe. Several people have written books and done their dissertations and doctorates on this network and how it literally changed the face of the contemporary art world in Eastern Europe.
Wow.
That's yeah.
Well, impressive.
So I think, you know, like George Soros has all this, you know, questionable agenda, but I know that the work that we did in the art world was really, really powerful. And for example, twice I took a whole group of East European artists to the Biennale in Istanbul and to Venice and to South America. So we took the art world that had been shut off, like amputated almost, and we brought it back into and integrated it. And now there's even programs exist today that we implemented that exchange, that allow for artist exchanges. So I feel very, very, very much positive that what we did was really a great job. And then a couple of years ago, I was reading one of David Icke's book, where he talks about the Soros Foundation. I was like, oh no. and that was the flip time for me, really. Mm-hmm. That was the big flip time.
But how was he to be around on a personal basis? I mean, how does he treat people around him?
So I think he was always a vision, clearly, and an agenda of how to do this and how to work. And you know, he is an older man. Yeah, he's an older, you know, sort of where is he, in his 80s now, maybe, I'm not sure. And you know, and I was this, you know, young, hip, sort of, you know, like I had short hair, sort of punk art world person. And I remember once walking into the office in New York, and he said, "Your hair is way too short, Susie." And I was like, "It's an open society, George. Like, my hair can be as short as I want it to be." And he's like, "But you're an executive director." And I was like, "Yes, but I'm an executive director in the art world." So you know, there was that sort of conservatism, of course, which we come across. But I always found him to be very open and I mean, he's very intelligent. There's no question about that. And, you know, like, there was one point where I was with him alone on a private jet flying from, I think, Hungary to Budapest, from Hungary to Romania. And, you know, there was a lot of private quiet time that we had together. And I always found him to be very respectful but clearly there was a discrepancy, because I'm from such a different world to him. So I was always, as I said, trying to convince him of the importance of spending money in the art world. And I eventually got the budget to like $1 million or something. So, you know, we did get it there. But there was a lot of private time where we were like, I had dinner with him, you know, in London, in his apartment, or in New York, or with his wife at the time, who was very involved with the art world. And so there was a personal relationship as well that was, you know, because of the work. But what I think I did get a shock was when the war was going on in Yugoslavia. And for people that don't know about that, that was a very horrific war. And there's still a lot of light coming out about that. But I was working, I had an office in Belgrade, so in Serbia. I had an office in Ljubljana, in Slovenia, an office in Croatia, in Zagreb. And I had directors and staff and board members in all of these countries. And I was asked if I would go to what was then Macedonia, Skopje, and to open an office there. And we couldn't get into Sarajevo at the time, and because of the war. And I was in Belgrade, and George had taken out some very large advertisement, I believe, in the New York Times, if I remember correctly. This is all so long ago, of course, but what he had done is he had said, "Yes, I believe that we should bomb Belgrade." And I was in Belgrade with the Belgrade Foundation, and people were like, how can you say that? We're all here. And so that's when I realized that perhaps the political agenda was greater than the family of foundations. And that's when I began to question really what was going on, perhaps a bit more. And then I actually caught a train with my assistant from Belgrade to Skopje, and we got attacked on the train by by soldiers, Serbian soldiers, who attempted to rape us and murder us. And that's when I realized that, and this unfortunately it happened a few times in that in Eastern Europe, and that's when I realized that I need greater protection doing this job. Like it's you know, it's a dangerous job. And so when I came back to, I think to New York or to Budapest, I mentioned that it's very difficult to be traveling through these countries when our boss is talking about bombing these countries. And
but you know, I've met quite a few people who have been dealing with the so-called elite on a personal basis. And it's like, for me, it feels like when you're talking about the weather and everything is nice and polite and so on, and then suddenly it's like this big canyon opens up when it comes to the way of looking upon, you know, humanity or normal people, that it just opens up like a deep abyss, you know, open, dark, that where you just feel, whoa, I thought I knew this individual, and then, whoa, there's this incredible difference in point of views.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I ever felt like I knew him so that well, but I would say that the people in the Belgrade Foundation at the time were absolutely stunned.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
We had a foundation in Sarajevo, in Bosnia, and I asked if I could go. I actually called up George and I said, I'd like to go and try and set up a center in Sarajevo during the war, or at least start some programming or some sort of connection, because when I was visiting my grandmother in southern Hungary in Pécs, you could literally hear the gunshots, you could hear the war, and it was amazing to me in Hungary how I, like, to me there's a war right next door, like across the border there's a war going on, and the Hungarian people, so many of the people that I spoke to said that's their war, it's not us. Fair enough, you know, but I was like, I'm going there. I want to do something. I want to help. I really wanted to go. So I rang up George and I said, can you get me into Sarajevo? I want to see if we can do something down there. And the foundation was working there. So I got a train to Zagreb, and then I got onto a UN, like a cargo carrier that was taking supplies and soldiers in to Sarajevo. And I called the office in Sarajevo. I contacted them and I said, so I'm coming to visit you. And they were, you know, very welcoming and said what the conditions were like. And I said, well, what should I bring? What do you need? And they said, bring whiskey, tampons, and chocolate. So I thought, okay.
That's the basic human need.
So I filled up my backpack and I was the only civilian on the plane. And I arrived and they said, when you arrive in Sarajevo, make sure that you get into an APC, an armored personnel carrier, like a tank, once you get off the plane, because the UN people are there waiting for you, that is from a Muslim country. So I'm thinking, how am I ever going to even work that out, you know, like at the tarmac? So I had
there,
that.
There was a lot of snipers at the time as well around the airport. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I arrived at the airport, and, you know, the soldiers have, you know, all their stuff on, you know, they've got all their flak jackets and everything. And as the plane lands, there's like all this crossfire going on. And one of the soldiers said, just crawl across the tarmac to that building. Like, that's the only way you can get there. And so as I got out of the plane, there's all this fire going on, and I'm just crawling across the tarmac thinking, what am I doing? Like, I've got a backpack full of whiskey. What am I doing? I'm crawling across and I get into this building. And from there, people just kind of grabbed you. And I got grabbed by a soldier and he put me into this APC and I got in it. And there was like a little velvet kind of tablecloth. And there was a holy book sitting on there.
A what?
And a holy book. A holy book. I didn't know which book it was, but it was a holy book. But I managed to get into a Muslim country, APC. And then they drove me down to through the town to the famous hotel, that big skyscraper kind of hotel where all the media were living, Sonsniper Alley. And I walked in there and then my friends from the foundation, the director came to pick me up, and then we got into this little car that was full of like gunshot wounds all over the car, bullet holes. We got into this car, and they said, "Just get down, and we're going to go through." So we drove through Sniper Alley, and it was really, it's just like fire, fire, fire. And then I stayed with these people for it was only supposed to be a few days, but I got stuck there. They were bombing heavily, and I couldn't get out. And we organized an exhibition that traveled around the world that they were already organizing called Witnesses of Existence that came to Budapest. And I organized for a beautiful book of poetry that was written by a Serbian, a Muslim soldier, actually, that was translated for us. And so there's so many stories that happened there, just living in a war zone, of course. But
So,
should I keep going?
Chocolate, tampons, and whiskey.
Yes.
That is, how did you experience being in a situation like that? I mean, that is not something normal people have experienced, being shot at and so on. There's so many different ways of handling it.
So for me, it was, I mean, what was so important about that was I never would have been in that situation if it hadn't have been for the foundation. So as many things we can say, you know, against the foundation or against George Soros as a person or whatever, or if we want to go into the, you know, the Illuminati understanding, what I felt there in that situation was the foundation was tremendous. And it really, I mean, the people on the ground were really doing very, very good work. And, you know, I felt like the work I did was, you know, profound for the artist, but for me that was such an intense spiritual experience. Living in a war zone, there's freezing cold, there was no electricity, very, you know, toilets didn't work, everything stank, there was no, very little food and water, and the people of Sarajevo were like, we're going to just keep living and we're just going to keep going normally, because their city was besieged, right? And the you could hear it, like, you know, there's all this terrible morbid, you know, war humor, you know, like, there's the bomb coming, and everyone would sit and wait, and if you heard it go over your head, then you were okay, right? If it didn't go over your head, obviously you weren't okay. And just the humanity of that situation, I mean, I know there's thousands, millions of people that have been in this situation, that live in war. And I feel strangely very blessed that I was in that situation, that I could really experience what is the deepest part of our humanity. And I remember there was at one point I was in a basement, I think, during a raid when they were bombing. And there was a Muslim soldier and a Serbian soldier and a Christian soldier, and they're all, you know, Bosnian soldiers, right? That was the whole thing, is that Sarajevo was like this melting pot of all of these cultures and religions, and that's what they were really fighting for. It's interesting to even be talking about that now, considering our state of the planet, right? And one of the soldiers said to me, like, why are you here? Like, an Australian from Budapest in the art world? I mean, like, really, why are you so fucking crazy to risk your life to be here? You know, like, this is mad. And, you know, I was scared. We were in a bomb shelter. I was scared. And one of the soldiers turned to him and said, look at her smile, just like when she smiles, right? And when she smiles, that's why she's here. And I was just like, what? He's like, it's your smile. Like, that's why you're here, because when you smile, you're helping us. Mm. Like, it doesn't matter if you're Australian or from Hungary or from George Soros' Foundation or from Planet Zeezon, whatever, you know, it's because you're here with a smile, and that's what's helping us. And I realized then, and for me, it was such a big moment, because, you know, there I was, executive director, you know, multi-million dollar budgets, blah, 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 you know, queen of the art world, whatever, you know, you have a lot of power in that position. And I was reduced to simply just being a person. No matter where I came from or who I was, it meant nothing. Mm-hmm. I was there because I was a human being, and because I wanted to be there, you know, in compassion and in support, in love, because I could smile. And that, to me, changed my life completely. Really. Ooh, I'm getting teary talking about it.
No, so do I. I mean, that is very big.
Yeah. It was really weird.
I'm very happy that they saw the beauty in you, you know, that they could receive it.
Well, we could, and that's it, is that we all have that. So to me, that's why I went into working in spirituality and spiritual teachings, is because we all have that. Like we can come to situations and bring resolution simply from the heart energy. It's all about love, right? I know you talk about that all the time too. That's what we need. It's not about the money or the greed, or it's about that humanity, that compassion. And when I was there, there were all of these incredible things that I heard of and saw from, you know, soldiers were coming back from the front and they were telling me about the mass graves and you know, all of the horrific things that were happening, and the just shocking things that they were doing to people. And when I came back to Hungary, well, first of all, when I left, I was on a cargo transport with a soldier lying in front of me who had lost two or three of his limbs, and he was just teetering on, I think he actually died during the flight. And I punctured one of my eardrums on the plane because it wasn't pressurized and things. And so when I arrived back, I was obviously, you know, PTSD and not hearing properly and obviously in shock. I felt guilty for turning on the light or for flushing the toilet, because I knew that so many people that I had just fallen so much in love with, you know, and they were all there in the same situation, yet I was leaving. And it took quite a while to come back to what I would call that reality. And I was telling people about what I'd heard and what I'd seen, and telling people that, you know, I was friends with people in the embassies and the different institutions there. And I told them about the mass graves, and people said, oh, that's not true. That's not true. It's not happening. And there was such a denial of what was going on there. It took many years before it came out, the real truth. So that also was very interesting, to see how I had come from the war zone, seen with my own eyes, heard these stories from the soldiers, and still the information was like, that's not true. And it's what I see today all the time with people. They don't want to hear it.
It's really interesting that we're talking about these things, because the big turning point for me was when I was in Iran in the middle of the war, on an old bicycle, just, I don't know how I really ended up there. And instead of meeting people that I was afraid of, because I thought they were just fanatic Muslims screaming Allah Akbar, shooting each other, you know. And instead, I met these incredibly beautiful people in an extremely difficult situation, where you really had to show yourself as a person, or you were revealed I mean, the inner you were revealed because you had to choose sides. Either you were the oppressor, the torturer, the guards, the military that were just doing horrific stuff to the population or in the war, or you were a freedom fighter, or you were just trying to survive in the middle, trying to get on with life and so on. And in the end, one of my new friends in Iran got murdered, and I risked everything. So I smuggled one of my new friends out of Iran through former Russia into East Germany and then up to Sweden, where the police tried to deport him, but we managed to get it stopped through. It was a beautiful old lady that worked for the police in that little town where I used to be a journalist. And so I approached her and she helped us right away and managed to stop the deportation. And then, and it's really funny because he actually got his medical education in Hungary because he couldn't get in Sweden. And now he's a heart specialist in Sweden.
Wow, and a then, heart specialist.
And then,
how symbolic is that?
I know. And then now, in the end, we got 7 more out, I think, of his family and closest friends to Sweden and Canada. But that was the turning point for me.
Mm-hmm.
And because for me, it was like I grew up with this inner wall. I felt that I couldn't get in touch with me. There was this mask on the outside, a smiling mask on the outside, and then an autopilot that was just and Sweden was too soft for me. There was too much cotton around. But that down there, it was like swallowing a dynamite stick, and so I exploded from the inside. And then it took me several years to recover. One of the books I've written is called Shadow of Tears, and that is about the exact things that happened down there and this whole thing, how, because these type of experiences, what you are talking about and my experience, I think they're so much bigger than us who were just part of that thing, because it's a matter of to see beyond color or race or religion. And when you suddenly, you're just stripped naked. I mean, who cared who you were or your background? If the bomb comes in, the bomb doesn't care. It will rip you apart or the other one apart. It doesn't matter. And it's just a matter of, am I lucky today or am I not? You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, I was asked just a few hours ago, I did an interview, and I haven't spoken about this for years. Now we sit and talk about your experience.
Synchronicity.
Synchronicity. And also the beauty in these horrific things. That's also, I think, where a lot of poetry and art and painting comes from, this pain. If it's that you're madly in love with someone who doesn't want you, or you come from a country that has been ripped apart by war, and so it's the same deep feeling that comes forward in different shapes and shades.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really happy that we had this conversation. I'm really, there's something, it hits me deep somehow. And I really admire, and I think you should salute yourself for going in there, the same way I salute myself of why the hell did I go into Iran on an old bicycle? I mean, how that there's no logic to it, but both of us followed our hearts. Because there was something pulling you, I'm sure that you felt sort of something inside you were pulling you in there.
It was just, I have to help. I can't stand back and say this is not my war.
Mm.
If every war, I think, is our war, because we're humans, and the fact that we're not Yugoslavians, it's like ridiculous. But to me, it's interesting because, like you say, to salute myself, and I have to say that the work that I'm doing now, in the same way, is just as much standing in the firing line. I mean, you know, this is, I mean, just to stand up sometimes and say, hey, I'm a homeopath, you know, it's put you in the firing line, or you know, I I went to Switzerland to see Billy Meyer puts you in the firing line, or talking about chemtrails, or it's amazing how you can literally become the target and have black cars in front of your house and
you don't like black cars.
Various IP addresses on your private lines, you know, like I think as I'm doing this work now and helping people to understand, like there's so many people that have no idea even about chemtrails and telling my students like, this is a chemtrail, this is a contrail. What's the agenda? What's going on? And just teaching people about that, it's amazing how dangerous that can become too. Mm. Not even opening your mouth about, well, that's a false flag event, you know. So to me, overcoming the fear is such a big thing. And that going to Sarajevo was definitely overcoming fear. Mm. But I think that that's something that we continue to do all the time in our work, in our stretching, even if stretching of the imagination. It's what we need to do is to be, if there was one word that I think is so important now in this world, it's to become fearless. And that's something I learned from Tibetan Buddhism.
I love it. I love it. That is what I say all the time. Let go of fear. If you don't know anything else, what else to do, let it go. Let go. Mm-hmm. Because that's the only way they control us. It's through fear. If we're not fearful.
And what's interesting is as a young child, I could see energy and, you know, see dimensionally. And so I believe we're all very, very psychic, very intuitive. But it's clearly now you can literally see fear. Like it has like a certain vibration. And what I've seen now is that when you're someone fearless, it opens up like a gaping chasm. And then even more stuff can come in that's not the essential self or not the sovereign field, which makes you more manipulatable. So what I've seen is that even just a tiny little ounce of fear, you know, it can grow very quickly and you can become manipulated. And that's what I'm seeing now is just how much fear there is and how much manipulation there is. And so that's why I've been following your work so much, because you help to deconstruct it, like word for word, piece for piece, so clearly, and without any spiritual babble or without any sort of political agenda, you're able to deconstruct it. And I think that's what's going on now, is we're in this very clear period of deconstruction of reality.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.